and baseball became his passion. Mom wanted me to be a doctor or a lawyer, but the old man didn't think I was smart enough.
Wait, your dad didn't think you were smart?
Smart enough. There's a difference. Defending his father even in death. People die, love endures. He wanted me to be an electrician like him. Dad was a big union guy, president of his local, stuff like that. That was the real reason he didn't want me to be a lawyer. Suits, he called them.
He had a problem with authority.
Razor shrugs. Be your own man, he always said. Don't be the man's man.
He shuffles his feet, embarrassed, like he's talking too much.
What about your old man?
He was an artist.
That's cool.
He was also a drunk.
Did more drinking than painting.
Though not always. Yellowed photographs of showings hanging crooked in dusty frames, and the students buzzing in his studio nervously cleaning brushes, and the cathedral hush that fell when he walked into a crowded room.
What kind of shit did he paint? Razor asks.
Mostly that.
Shit?
Not always, though. Not when he was younger and I was small, and the hand that held mine was stained with rainbow colors. He laughs.
The way you joke. Like you don't even know it's a joke, and it's your own joke.
I shake my head. I wasn't joking.
He nods. Maybe that's why you don't know it.
Chapter 63. After the evening meal I don't eat, and the forced banter and the minuscule awkward silences that drop between our sentences, and after the board comes out of the wooden box and he set up the pieces and we flip to see who's the home team and he wins, I tell him I think I can handle my own fielding, and he smirks.
Yeah, right, let's go, girl.
After he's sitting beside me on the edge of the bed, and after weeks of learning to let go of my rage and embrace the howling emptiness, and after years of erecting fortress walls around pain and loss, and the feeling that I will never feel again, after losing my father and losing Teacup and losing Zombie, and losing everything but the howling emptiness, and that is nothing, nothing at all, I silently say the word, hi. Razor nods.
Yeah.
He taps his finger on the blanket. I feel the tap against my thigh.
Yeah.
Tap.
Not bad. Though it's cooler when you do it in slow-mo,
he demonstrates.
Get it now?
If you insist, I sigh.
Yeah.
I tap my finger on the bed rail. Well, to be honest, I don't really see the point.
No?
Tap tap on the blanket. No. Tap tap on the rail. The next word takes over 20 minutes to trace. H-L-P. Tap.
Did I ever tell you about my summer job before there were no more summer jobs? He asks. Dog grooming. Worst part of the job? Expressing the anal glands.
He's on a roll. 4 runs and not a single out.
How?
I won't get an answer for another 40 minutes. I'm a little tired and more than a little frustrated. This is like texting with someone 1,000 miles away using one-legged runners. Time slows down. Events speed up. P-L-N. I have no idea what that means. I look at him, but he's looking at the board, moving the pieces back into position, talking, filling in the tiny silences that drop, stuffing the empty space with chatter.
That's what they actually call it, expressing, he says, still on the dogs. Rinse, wash, rinse, express, repeat. So freaking boring.
And the black, soulless, unblinking eye of the camera staring down. I didn't understand that last play, I tell him.
Chase ball isn't some lame-ass game like chess, he says patiently. There are intricacies. Intricacies. To win, you gotta have a plan.
And that's you, I guess. The man with the plan.
Yes, that's me.
Tap. Chapter 64. I hadn't seen Vosh in days. That changes the next morning.
Let's hear it, he tells Claire, who's standing beside Mr. Whitecoat looking like a middle schooler dragged into the principal's office for bullying the scrawny kid.
She's lost 8 pounds and 20% of her muscle mass. She's on Diavan for the high blood pressure, Finergan for the nausea, amoxicillin and streptomycin to keep her lymphatic system tamped down. But we're still struggling with the fever, Claire reports.
Struggling with the fever?
Claire's eyes cut away. On the upside, her liver and kidneys are still functioning normally. A bit of fluid in her lungs, but we're... Vosh waves her off and steps up to my bedside, bright bird eyes glittering.
Do you want to live?
I answer without hesitating. Yes.
Why?
The question takes me off guard for some reason. I don't understand.
You cannot overcome us. No one can. Not if you numbered 7 times 7 billion when it began. The world is a clock, and the clock has wound to its final second. Why would you want to live?
I don't want to save the world, I tell him. I'm just hoping I might get the opportunity to kill you. His expression doesn't change, but his eyes glitter and dance. I know you, his eyes say. I know you. Hope, he whispers. Yes. Nodding. He's pleased with me. Hope, Marika. Cling to your hope. He turns to Claire and Mr. Whitecoat. Pull her off the meds. Mr. Whitecoat's face turns the color of his smock. Claire starts to say something, then looks away. Vosh turns back to me.
What is the answer? He demands. It isn't rage. What is it?
Indifference.
Try again.
Detachment. Again. Hope. Despair. Love. Hate. Anger. Sorrow. I'm shaking. My fever must be spiking. I don't know. I don't know. I don't know.
Better, he says.
Chapter 65. It gets so bad that night I can barely make it through 4 innings of chase ball. X meds. Heard a rumor going around they took you off your meds, Razor says, shaking the quarter in his closed fist. True. The only thing left in my IV bag is saline to keep my kidneys from shutting down. He glances at my vitals on the monitor, frowning. When Razor frowns, he reminds me of a little boy who stubbed his toe and thinks he's too big to cry.
So you must be getting better.
Guess so. Tap, tap on the bed rail. Okay, he breathes.
My queen is up. Look out.
My back stiffens. My vision blurs. I lean to the side and empty my stomach, what little is inside my stomach, onto the white tile. Razor leaps up with a disgusted cry, toppling the board.
Hey!
He shouts. Not at me. At the black eye above us.
Hey, a little help here!
No help comes. He looks at the monitor, looks at me, and says,
I don't know what to do.
I'm okay.
Sure, you're fine, just fine.
He goes to the sink, wets a clean towel, and lays it across my forehead.
Find my ass! Why the hell did they take you off the meds?
Why not? I'm fighting the urge to hurl again.
Oh, I don't know, maybe because you'll die without them?
He glares at the camera. Maybe you should hand me that container over there. He dabs at the crud sticking on my chin, refolds the cloth, grabs the container, and places it on my lap.
Razor?
Yeah?
Please don't put that back on my face.
Huh? Oh, shit, yeah, hang on.
He grabs a clean towel and runs it under the water. His hands are shaking.
You know what it is? I know what it is. Why didn't I think of it? Why didn't you think of it? The meds must be interfering with the system.
What system?
The 12th system. The one they injected into you, Sherlock. The hub and his 44,000 little friends to supercharge the other 11.
He puts the cool towel on my forehead.
You're cold. You want me to find another blanket?
No, I'm burning up.
It's a war, he says. He taps his chest. In here. You gotta declare a truce, Ringer.
I shake my head. No peace. He nods, squeezing my wrist beneath the thin blanket. Squats on the floor to gather the fallen chess pieces. Curses when he can't find the quarter. decides he can't leave the vomit just lying there, grabs the dirty towel he used to wipe my chin and swabs the deck on his hands and knees. He's still cursing when the door opens and Claire comes into the room.
Good timing, Razor barks at her. Hey, can't you at least give her the anti-puke serum?
Claire jerks her head toward the door.
Get out.
She points at the box.
And take that with you.
Razor glowers at her, but he does it. I see again the tightly contained force behind his angelic features. Careful, Razor. That's not the answer. Then we're alone, and Claire studies the monitor for a long, silent moment.
Were you telling the truth earlier? She asks. You want to live so you can kill Commander Vash? You're smarter than that.
In the tone of a mother scolding a very young child.
You're right, I answer. I'll never get the chance,
but I'm going to have the opportunity to kill you. She looks startled.
Kill me? Why would you want to kill me?
When I don't answer, she says, I don't think you're going to live through the night. I nod. And you're not going to live out the month. She laughs. The sound of her laughter causes bile to rise into my throat. Burning. Burning.
What are you going to do?
She says softly. She yanks the towel from my forehead. Smother me with this?
No.
I'm going to overcome the guard by smashing his head in with a heavy object, and then I'm going to take his gun and shoot you in the face. She laughs through the whole thing.
Well, good luck with that.
It won't be luck. Chapter 66. Claire turns out to be wrong about me being dead by morning. Nearly a month later, by my reckoning of 3 meals per day, and I'm still here. I don't remember much. At some point, they disconnected me from the IV and the monitor, and the silence that slammed down after the constant beeping was loud enough to crack mountains. The only person I saw during that time was Razor. He's my full-time caretaker now. Feeds me, empties my bedpan, washes my face and hands, turns me so I don't develop bed sores, plays chase ball in the hours when I'm not delirious, and talks non-stop. He talks about everything, which is another way of saying he talks about nothing. His dead family, his dead friends, his squad mates, the drudgery of winter camp, the fights born of boredom and fatigue and fear, but mostly fear, the rumors that when spring comes, the Teds are launching a major offensive, a last-ditch effort to purge the world of the human noise, of which Razor is very much an active part. He talks and talks and talks. He had a girlfriend, her name was Olivia, and her skin was dark like a muddy river, and she played clarinet in the school band and was going to be a doctor, and hated Razor's dad because he didn't think Razor could be a doctor. He lets it slip that his given name is Alex, like A-Rod, and his drill sergeant named him Razor not because he was slender, but because he cut himself shaving one morning. I have very sensitive skin. His sentences are without periods, without commas, without paragraphs, or, to be accurate, it's all one long paragraph with no margins. He shuts up just one time after nearly a month of the verbal diarrhea. He's going on about how he won first place in the 5th grade science fair with his project about how to turn a potato into a battery when he stops in mid-sentence. His silence is jarring, like the stillness after a building implodes.
What is that?
He asks, staring intently into my face. And nobody stares more intently than Razor, not even Vash.
Nothing.
I turn my head away from him.
Are you crying, Ringer?
My eyes are watering.
No.
Don't tell me no, Razor. I don't cry.
Bullshit.
A tap on the blanket. Tap, tap on the railing. Did it work? I ask, turning back to him. What does it matter if he sees me cry? The potato battery.
Sure it worked. It's science. Never a doubt about it working. You plan it all out, follow the steps, and it can't go wrong.
Squeezing my hand through the blanket. Don't be scared. Everything's set. I won't let you down. It's too late to go back now anyway. His eyes wandered to the food tray beside the bed.
You ate all the pudding tonight. You know how they make chocolate pudding without chocolate? You don't want to know.
Let me guess. Ex-lax.
What's ex-lax?
Seriously, you don't know?
Oh, so sorry, I don't know what ex-lax who gives a shit is.
It's a chocolate-flavored laxative. He makes a face.
That's sick.
That's the point. He grins.
The point? Oh god, did you just make a joke?
How would I know? Just promise me nobody slipped ex-lax into my pudding.
Promise.
Tap. I last for a few hours after he leaves, long after lights out in every other part of the camp, deep into the belly of the winter night, before the pressure becomes unbearable, and then, when I can't take it anymore, I start shouting for help, waving at the camera, and then rolling over to press my chest against the cold metal railings, pounding my fist into the pillow in frustration and fury, until the door bursts open and Claire charges in, followed closely by a big bear of a recruit, whose hand immediately flies to cover his nose.
What happened?
Claire says, though the smell should tell her all she needs to know.
Oh, crap,
the recruit burbles behind his hand.
Exactly,
I gasp.
Great, just great,
Claire says, throwing the blanket and sheet onto the floor and motioning for the recruit to help her.
Fine job, Missy. I hope you're proud of yourself.
Not yet, I whimper.
What are you doing?
Claire shouts at the recruit. Gone is the soft voice. Vanished are the kind eyes.
Help me with this!
Help you with what, ma'am?
He has a flattened nose and very small eyes and a forehead that bulges in the middle. His belly hangs over his belt and his pants are an inch too short. He's huge. He's got about 100 pounds or more on me. It won't matter.
Get up!
Claire snaps at me.
Come on, get your legs under you!
She takes one arm and Jumbo Recruit takes the other and together they haul me out of the bed. Big Recruit's smushed-in face is twisted with revulsion.
Oh god, it's everywhere,
he softly wails.
I don't think I can walk,
I tell Claire.
Then I'll make you crawl, she snarls. I should just leave you like this. It's so perfectly metaphorical.
They haul me 2 doors down and into the shower room. Big Recruit is coughing and gagging, and Claire is bitching, and I am apologizing while she strips off the jumpsuit and throws it at Jumbo Recruit, telling him to wait outside.
Don't lean on me, lean on the wall,
she orders harshly. My knees are buckling. I hang onto the shower curtain to keep upright. I haven't used my legs in a month. With one hand locked around my left arm, Claire pushes me under the water, bending at the waist to stay dry. The spray is icy. She didn't bother to adjust the temperature. The slap of cold water against my body is like an alarm going off, snapping me from a long winter's hibernation. And I reach up and grab the showerhead pipe coming from the wall and tell Claire I think I've got it. I think I can stand. She can let go.
Are you sure?
She asks, holding on.
Pretty sure.
I wrench the pipe downward with all the force I have. The pipe breaks off at the joint with a metallic squeal, and the cold water gushes out in a ropey snarl. Left arm up, slipping through Claire's fingers, then I've got her by the wrist, and I swing my body toward her, rotating my hips to maximize the blow, and slam the jagged edge of the broken pipe into her neck. I wasn't sure I could break a steel pipe with my bare hands, but I was pretty sure. I have been enhanced. Chapter 67. Claire staggers away, blood pouring from the 2-inch puncture wound in her neck. The fact that I didn't drop her doesn't surprise me. I'd assumed she would be enhanced too, but I'd hoped to get lucky and sever her carotid artery. She fumbles in the pocket of her lab coat for the kill switch. I anticipated that. I toss the broken pipe away, grab the bolted-in shower rod, break it from its brackets, and smash one end into the side of her head. The impact barely rocks her. In a millisecond, faster than my eyes can follow the motion, she has the end of the rod in her grip. I let go in half a millisecond, so when she yanks, there's nothing holding the other end, and she stumbles back into the wall, hitting with enough force to crack the tiles. I barrel toward her. She swings the rod toward my head, but I anticipated that, too. Counted on it when I rehearsed this in the 1,000 silent hours beneath the constant glow. I grab the other end of the rod as it arcs toward me, first with my right hand, then with the left, hands shoulder-width apart, and power the rod into her neck, spreading my legs for the balance and leverage necessary to crush her windpipe. Our faces are inches apart. I'm close enough to smell the cyanide breath trickling out of her parted lips. Her hands are on either side of mine, pushing back while I push forward. The floor is slick. I'm barefoot. She isn't. I'm going to lose the advantage before she blacks out. I have to drop her, fast. I slide my foot to the inside of her ankle and kick out. Perfect. She falls to the floor and I follow her down. She lands on her back. I land on her stomach. I clamp my knees tightly against her sides and shove the rod down hard into her neck. Then the door behind us flies open and Jumbo Recruit lumbers in, gun drawn, shouting incoherently. 3 minutes in and the light in Claire's eyes is fading, but it's not all the way out. And I know I have to take a risk. I don't like risk. Never did. I just learned to accept it. Some things you can choose and some you can't. Like Sullivan's crucifix soldier, like teacup. Like going back for zombie and nugget because not going back meant there's no value to anything anymore. Not life, not time, not promises. And I have a promise to keep. Jumbo's gun. The 12th system locks in on it, and thousands of microscopic droids go to work augmenting the muscles, tendons, and nerves in my hands, eyes, and brain to neutralize the threat. In a microsecond, objective identified, information processed, method determined. Jumbo doesn't have a prayer. The attack happens faster than his unenhanced brain can process it. I doubt he even sees the curtain rod whizzing toward his hand. The gun flies across the room. He goes one way, for the gun, while I go the other, for the toilet. The tank lid is solid ceramic, and heavy. I could kill him. I don't. But I smack him hard enough in the back of the head to put him out for a long time. Jumbo falls down. Claire rises up. I sling the lid toward her head. Her arm rises to block the projectile. My enriched hearing picks up the sound of a bone snapping from the collision. The silver device in her hand clatters to the floor. She dives for it as I step forward. I slam one foot on her outstretched hand and with the other kick the device to the other side of the room. Done. And she knows it. She looks past the barrel of the gun leveled at her face. Beyond the tiny hole filled with immense nothingness. Into my eyes. And hers are kind again. And her voice is soft again. The bitch. Marika. No. Marika was slow, weak, sentimental, dim-witted. Marika was a little girl clinging to rainbow fingers, helplessly watching the time wind down, teetering on the razor's edge of the bottomless abyss, exposed behind her fortress walls by promises she could never keep. But I will keep her final promise to Claire, the beast who stripped her naked and baptized her in the cold water that still roars in the broken shower. I will keep Marika's promise. Marika is dead, and I will keep her promise. My name is Ringer. I pull the trigger. Chapter 68. Jumbo should have a knife on him. Standard issue for all recruits. I kneel beside his unconscious body, slip the knife from its sheath, and carefully cut out the pellet embedded near the spinal cord at the base of his skull. I slip it between my cheek and gums. Now mine. No pain when I cut it out, and only a small amount of blood trickles from the incision. Bots to deaden sensation. Bots to repair damage. That's why Claire didn't die when I rammed a broken pipe into her neck and why, after the initial gush, the bleeding quickly stopped. Also why, after 6 weeks flat on my back with very little food and a burst of intense physical activity, I'm not even out of breath. I insert the tiny pellet from my neck into Jumbo's. Track me now, Commander Asshole. Fresh jumpsuit from the stack under the sink. Shoes. Claire's feet are too small. Jumbo's much too large. I'll work on the shoes later. The big kid's leather jacket might come in handy, though. The jacket hangs on me like a blanket, but I like the extra room in the sleeves. There's something I'm forgetting. I glance around the small room. The kill switch, that's it. The screen got cracked in the melee, but the device still works. A number glows above the flashing green button, my number. I swipe my thumb over the display and the screen fills with numbers, hundreds of sequences representing every recruit on the base. I swipe again to return to my number, tap on it, and a map pops up showing my implant's precise location. I zoom out and the screen fills with tiny glowing green dots, the location of every implanted soldier in the entire base. Jackpot. And checkmate. With a swipe of my thumb and a tap of my finger, I can highlight all the numbers. The button on the bottom of the device will light up. A final tap, and every recruit neutralized. Gone. I can practically stroll out. I can, if I'm willing to step over several hundred corpses of innocent human beings, kids who are no less victims than I am, whose sole crime is the sin of hope. If the wage of sin is death, then virtue is a vice now. A defenseless, starving child lost in a wheat field is given shelter. A wounded soldier cries out for help behind a row of beer coolers. A little girl shot by mistake is delivered to her enemies in order to save her. And I don't know which is more inhuman, the alien beings that created this new world, or the human being who considers, if only for an instant, pressing the green button. Three large clumps of stationary dots hover on the right side of the screen, the sleeping. A dozen isolated individuals on the periphery, sentries. Two in the middle, mine and Jumbo's neck, his in my mouth. Another three or four very close, on the same floor, the sick and injured. One floor down, the ICU, where only one green sphere glows. So, barracks, observation posts, hospital. A couple of the sentry dots are manning the magazine building. I won't have to guess which two. I'll know in a few minutes. Come on, Razor, let's go. I've got one last promise to keep. Watching the gusher pour from the broken pipe. Chapter 69.
Do you pray?
Razor asked me after an exhausting night of chase ball while he packed up the game board in pieces. I shook my head. Do you?
Damn right I do,
nodding his head emphatically.
No atheists in foxholes.
My father was one.
A foxhole?
An atheist.
I know that ringer.
How did you know my father was an atheist?
I didn't.
Then why did you ask if he was a foxhole?
I didn't. It was a freaking...
He smiled.
Oh, I get it. I know what you're doing. The disturbing thing to me is why. Like you're not trying to be funny, but trying to prove how superior you are, or think you are. You're not either funny or superior.
Why don't you pray?
I don't like putting God on the spot.
He picked up the queen and examined her face.
You ever checked her out? She is one scary-looking she-bitch.
I think she looks regal.
She looks like my third-grade teacher, a lot of man and very little woe.
What?
You know, heavy on the male, light on the fee.
She's just fierce. A warrior queen.
My third-grade teacher?
He studied my face. Waiting. Waiting.
Sorry, tried that joke once, epic fail.
He placed the piece in the box.
My grandma belonged to a prayer circle.
You know what a prayer circle is?
Yes.
Really? I thought you were an atheist.
My father was an atheist. And why couldn't an atheist know what a prayer circle is?
Religious people know about evolution.
I know what it is. I've got it.
He said thoughtfully, dark, intense eyes still on my face.
You were like 5 or 6, and some relative remarked in a very positive way what a serious little girl you were. And from then on, you thought seriousness was attractive.
What happened in the prayer circle? Attempting to get him back on track.
Ha! So you don't know what it is.
He set the box down and scooched farther onto the bed, his butt now touching my thigh. I eased my leg away. Subtly, I hoped.
I'll tell you what happened. My grandma's dog got sick. One of those purse dogs that bites everybody and lives about 25 years biting people. So her petition had to do with God saving that mean little dog so it could bite more people. And half the old ladies in the group agreed and half didn't, I'm not sure why. I mean, a God who doesn't like dogs wouldn't be God, but anyway. There was this big debate about wasted prayer, which became an argument about if there could be such a thing as wasted prayer, which turned into a fight about the Holocaust. So, in 5 minutes, it went from a nippy old purse dog to the Holocaust.
So, what happened? Did they pray for the dog?
No, they prayed for the souls of the Holocaust. Then the next day the dog died.
And now he was nodding thoughtfully. Grandma prayed for him. Prayed every night. Told all us grandkids to pray too.
So I prayed for a dog that terrorized and hated me and gave me this.
He swung his leg onto the bed and pulled up his pants to expose his calf.
See the scar?
I shook my head.
No. Well, it's there.
He pushed down the pants leg but kept his foot on the bed.
So after it died, I said to Grandma, I prayed really hard and Flubby still died. Does God hate me?
What did she say?
Some BS about God wanting Flubby in heaven, which was impossible for my 6-year-old brain to process. There are nippy old purse dogs in heaven. Isn't heaven supposed to be a nice place? It bothered me for a long time. Like every night while I said my prayers, I couldn't help but wonder if I even wanted to go to heaven and spend eternity with Flubby. So I decided he must be in hell. Otherwise, theology falls apart.
He wrapped his long arms around his upraised knee, where he rested his chin and stared into space. He was back in a time when a little boy's questions about prayer and God and heaven still mattered.
I broke a cup once, he went on. Playing around in Mom's china cabinet, part of her wedding set, his dainty little cup from a tea set. Didn't totally break it, dropped it on the floor and it cracked.
The floor?
No, not the floor, the c-
His eyes widened in shock.
Did you just make the same-
I shook my head. He pointed his finger at me.
Nah, I caught you. A moment of lighthearted levity from Ringer the Warrior Queen.
I joke all the time.
Right, but they're so subtle that only smart people get them.
The cup, I prodded him.
So, I've cracked Mom's precious china. I put it back in the cabinet, turning its cracked side toward the back so maybe she won't notice, even though I know it's only a matter of time before she does and I'm dead meat. Know where I turn for help?
I didn't have to think hard. I knew where the story was going.
God. God. I prayed for God to keep Mom away from that cup. Like for the rest of her life. Or at least until I moved away to college. Then I prayed that he could heal the cup. He's God, right? He can heal people. What's a tiny freaking made-in-China cup? That was the optimal solution, and that's what he's all about. Optimal solutions.
She found the cup.
You bet your ass she found the cup.
I'm surprised you still pray. After Flubby and the cup? He shook his head. Not the point.
There's a point? If you let me finish the story, yes, there is a point. Here it is. After she found the cup, and before I knew she'd found it, she replaced it. She ordered a new cup and threw away the old one. One Saturday morning, I guess I'd been praying for about a month, I went to the cabinet to prove the prayer circle wrong about wasted prayer, and I saw it.
The new cup, I said.
Razor nodded.
But you didn't know your mom replaced it.
He threw his hands into the air. It's a fucking miracle! What's cracked has been uncracked. The broken made whole. God exists.
I nearly crapped my pants. The cup was healed, I said slowly. His dark eyes dug deep into mine. His hand fell to my knee. A squeeze, then a tap. Yes.
Chapter 70.
In the bathroom, the gush becomes a stream, the stream becomes a trickle, the trickle becomes an anemic dribble. The water slows and my heart quickens. My paranoia was getting the better of me. A decade passed while I waited for the water to be cut off, the go signal from Razor. The hall outside is deserted. I already know that thanks to Claire's tracking device. I also know exactly where I'm going. Stairs. One flight down. One last promise. I pause long enough on the landing to slip Jumbo's sidearm into the jacket pocket. Then I slam through the door and hit the hall running. Straight ahead is the nurse's station. I sprint straight toward it. The nurse pops out of her chair.
Take cover! I shout. It's going to blow!
I swerve past the counter and race toward the swinging doors that lead to the ward.
Hey! She shouts. You can't go back there!
Any day now, Razor. She hits the lockdown button on her desk. It doesn't matter. I hurtle into the doors at full speed and smash both off their hinges.
Freeze!
She screams. The entire length of the hallway remains. I won't make it. I've been enhanced, but I can't outrun a bullet. I skitter to a halt. Razor, I'm serious. Now would be a very good time.
Hands on your head, now.
Struggling to catch her breath.
Good job. Now walk toward me, backward. Slow. Very slow, or I swear to God I'll shoot you.
I obey, shuffling toward the sound of her voice. She orders me to stop. I stop. I'm still, but the mechanisms inside me aren't. Her position is fixed. I don't have to see her to know exactly where she's standing. The hubs dispatch the managers of my muscular and nervous systems to execute the directive when called upon. I won't have to think when the time comes. The hub will take over. But I won't owe my life entirely to the 12th system. It was my idea to grab Jumbo's jacket. And that reminds me. Shoes, I murmur.
What did you say?
Her voice is quivering. I need shoes. What size are you?
Huh?
At the speed of light, the hub signal fires. My body doesn't move quite that fast, but double the speed that is probably necessary. Right hand jams into Jumbo's baggy sleeve where I slip the 10-inch knife, pivot to the left, then the throw. And down she goes. I pull the knife from her neck, slide the bloody blade back into the left sleeve of the jacket, and check out her shoes. A pair of those white, thick-soled nurse's shoes. A half size too big, but they'll work. At the end of the hallway, I step into the last room on the right. It's dark, but my eyes have been enhanced. I can see her clearly in the bed, fast asleep. Or doped. I'll have to determine which.
Teacup? It's me, Ringer.
The thick, dark lashes flutter. I'm so jacked up by this point, I swear I can hear the tiny hairs thrumming the air. She whispers something without opening her eyes. Too soft for the unenhanced to hear, but the auditory bots transmit the information to the hub, which relays it to the inferior colliculus, the hearing center of my brain.
You're dead.
Not anymore, and neither are you. Chapter 71. The window beside the bed jiggles in its frame. The floor quivers. Bright orange light floods the room, winks out, then an ear-splitting roar and a fine mist of plaster floating down from the ceiling. The sequence repeats. Then again. Then again. Razors hit the magazine building.
Teacup, we have to go.
I slide one hand behind her head and lift gently.
Go where?
As far as we can. Bracing the back of her head with one hand, I hit her in the forehead with the heel of the other. The precise amount of force, no more, no less. Her body goes limp. I heave her out of the bed. Another blast as the ordnance in the magazines continues to detonate. I kick out the window. Bitter, cold air crashes into the room. I sit on the sill facing the bed, cradling teacup against my chest. My intent alerts the hub. I'm two stories above the ground. Reinforcements race to the bones and tendons in my feet, ankles, shins, knees, and pelvis. We deploy. I flip as we drop, like a cat falling off a countertop. We land safely, like a cat, except Teacup's head bounces up on impact and smacks me hard under the chin. In front of us, the hospital. Behind us, the blazing ammunition storehouse. And to our right, exactly where Razor said it would be, the black Dodge M882. I throw open the door, shove Teacup into the passenger seat, jump behind the wheel, and take off across the parking lot, cutting hard to the left to make the turn north toward the airfield. A siren screams. Floodlights blare. In the rearview mirrors, emergency vehicles race toward the burning magazine. The fire brigade will have a hard time of it since someone has shut down the pumping station. Another hard left, and now straight ahead are the hulking bodies of the Blackhawks, glistening like the bodies of black beetles in the harsh light of floods. I grip the wheel hard and take a deep breath. This is the trickiest part. If Razor couldn't kidnap a pilot, we're all screwed. 100 yards away, I see someone jump from one of the chopper's holds. He's wearing a heavy parka and toting an assault rifle.
His face is partially obscured by the hood, but I'd know that smile anywhere. I hop from the M882, and Razor says,
Hi.
Where's the pilot? I ask. He jerks his head toward the cockpit.
I got mine, where's yours?
I pull Teacup from the truck and jump inside the chopper. A guy wearing nothing but a drab green t-shirt and a matching pair of boxer shorts sits behind the controls. Razor slides into the co-pilot seat beside him.
Fire her up, Lieutenant Bob!
Razor grins at the pilot.
Oh, manners. Ringer, Lieutenant Bob. Lieutenant Bob, Ringer.
There's no way this is going to work, Lieutenant Bob says. They'll come after us hard.
Yeah? What's this?
Razor holds up a mass of tangled electrical wire. The pilot shakes his head, so cold his lips are turning blue.
I don't know.
Neither do I, but I'm guessing they're very important for the proper operation of a helicopter.
You don't understand.
Razor leans toward him and all his playfulness is gone. His deep-set eyes burn as if backlit, and the coiled force I sensed from the beginning springs free with such ferocity, I actually flinch.
Listen to me, you alien son of a bitch. You fire this mother-effing stick buddy up ASAP or I'm...
The pilot shoves his hands into his lap and stares straight ahead. After getting one into the chopper undetected, my biggest concern was getting a pilot to cooperate. I lean forward, grab Bob by the wrist, and bend his pinky finger backward.
I'll break it, I promise him.
Go ahead!
I break it.
His teeth clamp down on his bottom lip. His legs jerk. His eyes swim with tears. That shouldn't happen. I press my fingers against the back of his neck, then turn to Razor.
He's implanted. He isn't one of them.
Yeah, well, who the hell are you?
The pilot squeals. I pull the tracking device from my pocket. There's the hospital and the magazine surrounded by a swarm of green dots. And there are three dots glowing on the airstrip.
You cut yours out, I say to Razor.
He's nodding.
And left it under my pillow. That was the plan, or was that the plan?
Shit, Ringer, wasn't that the plan?
A little panicky. I drop the knife into my hand.
Hold him.
Razor understands immediately. He grabs Lieutenant Bob and puts him in a headlock. Bob doesn't put up much resistance. I worry now that he might go into shock. If he does, it's over. There isn't much light, and Razor can't hold him perfectly still. So I tell Bob to chill, or I might sever his spinal cord, adding paralysis to the problem of a broken finger. I pull out the pellet, toss it onto the tarmac, yank Bob's head back, and whisper in his ear, I'm not the enemy, and I haven't gone Dorothy. I'm just like you.
Only better, Razor finishes. He glances through the window and says, Ringer?
I see them. The glow of headlights expanding like a pair of stars going supernova. They're coming, and when they get here, they will kill us. I tell Bob, you too. They won't believe you, and they will kill you. Bob stares into my face, tears of pain streaming down his.
You have to trust me, I say.
Or she'll break another finger,
Razor adds.
A deep, shuddering breath, shaking uncontrollably, cradling his wounded hand, blood trickling down his neck and soaking into the collar of his t-shirt.
It's hopeless,
he whispers.
They'll just shoot us down.
On impulse, I reach forward and press my hand against his cheek. He doesn't recoil. He becomes very still. I don't understand why I touched him or what's happening now that I am, but I feel something opening inside me, like a bud spreading its delicate petals toward the sun. I'm freezing cold. My neck is on fire. And the little finger on my right hand throbs to the beat of my heart. The pain brings tears to my eyes. His pain.
Ringer!
Razor barks.
What the hell are you doing?
I pour my warmth into the man I touch. I douse the fire. I caress the pain. I soothe his fear. His breath evens out. His body relaxes. Bob, we really have to go, I tell him. And 2 minutes later, we do.
Chapter 72. As we ascend, the truck screeches to a stop and a tall man steps out, and his face is a study in deep shadows thrown by the floods. But I see his eyes with eyes enhanced, bright and hard like the crows in the woods. Polished blue while the crows were black. And it must be a trick of light or shadow the small, tight smile he seems to wear.
Keep us low, I order Bob.
Where are we going?
South. The chopper banks. The ground rushes toward us. I see the magazine burning and the spinning lights of the fire trucks and recruits swarming around like ants. We pass over a river, black water sparking in the spillover light from the floods. Behind us now, the camp is an oasis of light in a desert of winter dark. We plunge into that dark, skimming 6 feet above the treetops. I slide into the seat next to Teacup, lean her into my chest, and pull her hair to one side. I hope this is the last time I have to do this. When I'm done, I crush the implant with the heel of the knife. Razor's voice squawks in my headset.
How's she doing?
Okay, I think.
How are you doing?
Good.
Glitches?
Minor, you?
Smooth as a newborn baby's ass.
I ease Teacup back into the seat, stand up, and open compartments until I find the chutes. Razor rattles on as I check the assemblies.
Anything you want to say to me? Like, I don't know, thank you, Razor, for saving my ass from a lifetime of alien servitude after I punched you in the throat and generally acted like a douchebag? Something along those lines? You know, it wasn't exactly like taking a walk in baseball, secret codes embedded in bogus games and slipping laxative and pudding and rigging explosives and stealing trucks and kidnapping pilots with fingers for you to break. Maybe, hey, Razor, I couldn't have done it without you. You rock. Something like that. Doesn't have to be word for word, just something to capture the general spirit.
Why did you? I ask. What made you decide to trust me?
What you said that day about the kids. Turning kids into bombs. I did some asking around. Next thing I know, I'm in the Wonderland chair and then they take me to the commander and he's all down on my ass about something you said. And he orders me to stop talking to you because he can't order me to stop listening. And the more I think about it, the stinkier it gets. They train us to terminate Teds and then load down toddlers with alien ordnance? Who are the good guys here? And then I'm like, who am I here? It got really angsty, a real existential crisis. What tipped it for me, though, was the math.
Math?
Yeah, math. Aren't all you Asians really good at math?
Don't be racist.
And I'm 3/4 Asian. 3/4. See? Math. It comes down to simple addition. As in, it doesn't add up. Okay, so maybe we get lucky and seize the Wonderland program from them. Even super superior aliens can screw up. Nobody's perfect. But we don't just snatch Wonderland. We have their bombs. We have their track and kill implants. Their super sophisticated nanobot system. Shit, we even have the technology capable of detecting them. What the fuck? We've got more of their weapons than they do. But the real kicker came that day they jacked you up, when Vosh said they lied to us about the organism attached to human brains. Unbelievable!
Because if that's a lie, then everything's a lie. Below us, the land is covered in a blanket of white. The horizon is indiscernible in the dark, lost. Everything is a lie. I thought of my dead father telling me that I belong to them now. Instinctively, I gather Teacup's little hand into mine. Truth. I hear Bob say in the headset,
I'm confused.
Relax, Bob, Razor says.
Hey, Bob. Wasn't that the major's name at Camp Haven? What's it with officers and the name Bob?
An alarm sounds. I return Teacup's hand to her lap and shuffle forward.
What is it?
Company, Bob says. 6 o'clock.
Choppers?
Negative. F-15s, 3 of them.
How much time before they're in range?
He shakes his head. Despite the cold, his shirt is soaked in sweat. His face shines with it.
5 to 7?
Bring us up, I tell him. Maximum altitude.
I grab a couple parachute rigs and drop one into Razor's lap.
We're bailing? He asks.
We can't engage and we can't outrun. You're with Teacup. Tandem jump.
I'm with Teacup? Who are you with?
Bob glances at the other rig in my hand.
I'm not bailing, he says.
And then, just in case I didn't hear or don't understand,
I'm not bailing.
No plan is perfect. I'd planned for a silencer bob, which meant my plan entailed killing him before we bailed from the chopper. Now it's complicated. I didn't kill Jumbo for the same reason I don't want to kill Bob. Kill enough Jumbos, murder enough Bobs, and you've plunged to the same depths as the ones who shove a bomb down a toddler's throat. I shrugged to hide my uncertainty, tossed the rig into his lap.
Then I guess you get incinerated.
We're at 5,000 feet. Dark sky, dark ground, no horizon, all dark. The bottom of a lightless sea. Razor is looking at the radar screen, but he says to me,
"Where's your chute, Ringer?"
I ignore the question.
"Can you give me a 60-second ETA on their range?"
I ask Bob. He nods. Razor asks the question again.
"It's math," I tell him, which I'm three-quarters really good at. If there are four of us and they mark two chutes, that leaves at least one of us on board. One, maybe two of them will stay with the chopper at least until they can take it down. It'll buy time.
What makes you think they'll stay with the chopper?
I shrug. It's what I do.
Still doesn't answer my question about your chute. They're hailing us, Bob announces, ordering us to set it down.
Tell them to suck it, Razor says.
He stuffs a piece of bubblegum into his mouth. Taps his ear.
Popping's bad.
Jams the gum wrapper into his pocket. Notices I'm watching and smiles.
Never noticed all the crap in the world until there was nobody left to pick it up, he explains. The Earth is my charge.
Then Bob calls out,
60 seconds!
I tug on Razor's parka. Now. He looks up at me and says slowly and distinctly,
Where's your freaking chute?
I haul him out of the seat one-handed. He chirps in surprise, stumbling toward the back. I follow him, squat in front of Teacup to remove her harness.
40 seconds! How are we going to find you?
Razor yells, standing right next to me.
Head for the fire.
What fire?
30 seconds!
I haul open the hatch door. The blast of air that punches into the hold blows Razor's hood off his head. I scoop up Teacup and press her into his chest.
Don't let her die.
He nods.
Promise.
Nods again.
I promise.
Thank you, Razor, I say. For everything. He leans forward and kisses me hard on the mouth.
Don't ever do that again,
I tell him.
Why? Because you liked it or because you didn't?
Both.
15 seconds.
Razor maneuvers Teacup over his shoulder, grabs the safety cable, and shuffles back until his heels touch the jump pad. Silhouetted in the opening, the boy and the child over the boy's shoulder, and 5,000 feet beneath them the limitless dark. The Earth is my charge. Razor releases the cable. He doesn't seem to fall. He is sucked out into the ravenous void. Chapter 73. I head back to the cockpit, where I find the pilot's door unlatched, the seat empty, and no Bob. I wondered why the countdown stopped. Now I know. He changed his mind about the whole bailing issue. We must be in range, which means they don't intend to shoot us down. They've marked the location of Razor's drop, and they'll stay with the chopper until I bail or it runs out of fuel and I'm forced to bail. By this point, Vosh has figured out why Jumbo's implant is on this aircraft while its owner is in the infirmary being treated for a very bad headache. With the tip of my tongue, I push the pellet from my mouth and lick it onto my palm.
Do you want to live?
Yes, and you want that too, I tell Vosh. I don't know why, and hopefully I never will. I flick the pellet from my hand. The hub's response is instantaneous. My intent alerted the central processor, which calculated the overwhelming probability of terminal failure and shut down all but the essential functions of my muscular system. The 12th system has the same order I gave Razor. Don't let her die. Like a parasite's, the system's life depends on the continuation of mine. The instant my intent changes, okay, fine, I'll parachute out, the hub will release me. Then and only then. I can't lie to it or bargain with it. Can't persuade it. Can't force it.
Unless I change my mind, it can't